Welcome to Mysterious Topics, a podcast focusing on intriguing topics deserving further scrutiny. Each episode, the hosts examine a topic, add their opinions, and hopefully pique your interest as well. Visit MysteriousTopics.com for contact information and more. Now, here are your hosts, Chuck and John.
Hello, John.
Hi, Chuck. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Great. So tonight, our topic is going to be on Area 51. It's also officially known as Groom Lake or Homey Airport. It's a remote detachment of the Edwards Air Force Base. According to the Central Intelligence Agency, the correct names for the Area 51 facility are the Nevada Test and Training Range and Groom Lake, though the name Area 51 was used in a CIA document from the Vietnam War. Other names used for the facility include Dreamland and nicknames Paradise Ranch, Home Base, Watertown, and Groom Lake. This special use airspace around the field is referred to as Restricted Area 4808 North. It is located in the southern portion of Nevada in the western United States, 83 miles north-northwest of Las Vegas. Situated at its center on the southern shore of Groom Lake is a large military airfield. The base's current primary purpose is publicly unknown. However, based on historical evidence, it is most likely supports development and testing of experimental aircraft and weapons systems. The intense secrecy surrounding the base has made it a frequent subject of conspiracy theories and a central component to unidentified flying objects, or UFO folklore. Although the base has never been declared a secret base, all research and occurrings in Area 51 are top secret, sensitive, compartmented information.
Yeah, I'd like to add that even going back a little farther into World War II, 1942 to be exact, the field was actually called Indian Springs Air Force Auxiliary Field. So it goes back a number of years, even beyond 1951, when it perhaps it is the date that most people recognize as when it started. So it goes back a few years before that. And when I think of Area 51, I think of Art Bell. I know you've listened to Art Bell in the past, and even back in the 1990s, Art Bell was kind of a nighttime companion. And I think Art Bell probably did more topics on Area 51 than on any other topic. I'm not certain of that, but I know he did a number of topics on Area 51. And part of that might be where he was located. He was in Pahrump, Nevada, just a little bit outside of Las Vegas, so he was very close to Area 51.
Yeah, I was just going to say that I didn't listen to that program a whole lot back then. It was on overnight, I believe. It started really late. But I just happened to hear one fascinating show when a guy called into his show and said that he was flying his airplane in, and he was going in to find out what was going on at Area 51. Did you hear that show by chance?
I did, and actually I just listened to it on YouTube a couple of days ago. And, you know, it perhaps could be a total fake, a total misleading of everybody, but it surely sounds authentic. And anyone that has not heard it that might be interested in that, just go to YouTube and search for something like call from a pilot over Area 51. And it's about a 10-minute phone call, and it's really...
Yeah, it's very dramatic, it's reminiscent of the... almost like the War of the Worlds radio program, where everybody supposedly thought it was real for a while. But whether or not it was real, it was very good theater.
Yes, and Art Bell kept saying to him, I think maybe you shouldn't be doing this. You know, I think you might want to reconsider. He kept talking about that.
Yeah.
And that's another thing about Art Bell. He always seemed to ask the right question at the right time. And he also knew when to be quiet and let, you know, his guest or a caller speak and finish his thought. Because I think that was a big attraction to listening to Art Bell. He was a very good communicator.
Well, the other thing quickly about him, too, and that's kind of what we would like to do on this program, is when he would have somebody on, regardless of how crazy the topic was that this person was talking about or believed in, Art asked some questions and didn't lean one way or the other. He took it as matter-of-factly as just, you know, he gave the person respect and, you know, didn't necessarily believe or disbelieve.
No matter what topic it was, he had an open mind. In the back of his mind, he probably was thinking, oh my gosh, what's this guy talking
about?
Yeah,
I'm sure he was.
He didn't present that on the air.
So
yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, so they call it Groom Lake, and of course there's no lake there. There's not water, but it's in a dry lake bed. I was kind of curious, thinking about, okay, it's, when was the last time there would have been water in this lake? And I guess it turns out it would have been a long, long time ago.
Well, one thing about the lake bed, which we didn't mention yet, when they first located Area 51, where it is located, one of the reasons was because the lake bed is very smooth, which provided a natural landing field even before they had concrete runways in the down the road.
Yes.
And what were you going to say about when do you think the lake bed was actually a lake with water in it? Do you have any idea, or you're not sure?
Well, it was in the Pleistocene era, which was well over 10,000 years ago.
Maybe that whole area was covered with water back then, and that might have been just a low point. You know, I'm not sure, but I wouldn't doubt it.
Yeah, it was. Now I'm having a hard time finding the information I was going to talk, but it was a long time ago, and it does, every once in a while, if they get a lot of rain, it can puddle up slightly, and it can these little brine shrimp will come up out of the water and survive for a while. I don't know. It's kind of interesting that these little things are, I guess they're, I don't know what they are. They're almost like those little sea monkeys or something.
And they do get occasional heavy downpours. I know just recently, even in the desert area of Arizona, they had record rainfall and flooding. So I know that this area also occasionally gets rainfall. Most of the time it's totally dry, but occasionally it does.
Yes, yes.
But it's a very desolate area. And, you know, it's not a place that you normally would want to live because of, you know, it's just dry and the scenery is pretty much flat and uninviting. And in fact, when the government was first recruiting workers to go to Area 51, they called it Paradise Ranch in an effort to entice people to go there, even though it was a desolate area. Later, everyone just started calling it the ranch, you know, which made it sound a little better than this remote, dry, desolate place, which it really was.
Yeah, I guess the original rectangular base was 6 by 10 miles, and it's now part of the so-called Groom Box, a rectangular area measuring 23 by 25 miles of restricted airspace that gentleman that called Art Bell was flying into that one night. The area is connected to the internal Nevada test site, road network and paved roads leading south to Mercury and west to Yucca Flat. Leading northeast from the lake, the wide and well-maintained Groon Lake Road runs through a pass in the Jumbled Hills. The road formerly led to mines in the Groom Basin, but has been improved since their closure. Its winding course runs past a security checkpoint, but the restricted area around the base extends further east. After leaving the restricted area, Groom Lake Road descends eastward to the floor of the Tickaboo Valley, passing the dirt road entrances to several small ranches before converging with State Route 375, also known as the Extraterrestrial Highway, south of Rachel, Nevada.
Yeah, I can see a bunch of tourists flocking to that area when they hear that term.
Yeah, well, and I think they do, yes. People like to go up and they can get to a certain point and try to look over the hills into the area where the base is. And if they go any further, they all of a sudden from nowhere a vehicle comes driving out, or helicopters or something, and if they go onto the property, I believe there are signs that say they will shoot to kill anybody that comes onto the base.
Yeah, that would keep me away, I guess. Well, the main purpose for Area 51 is not definitely known, but I know that almost every country, or any superpower especially, actually needs a place like Area 51 to develop technology, weapons of a different kinds. It's just a place where there's going to be secrecy. I mean, if you don't have that, you don't have any advantage over other, perhaps, countries that might be a nemesis to you. Nemesis, I should say. But anyway, it was used for developing spy planes. I don't know if you were probably too young, John, back in 1960 when a U-2 spy plane was shot down over Russia. And that was Francis Gary Powers. It was supposedly something that didn't exist. Our government said, oh no, this wasn't us, but apparently the Soviet Union spotted it over its area and shot it down. Actually, in the process of shooting it down, they shot down one of their own planes. They sent several missiles up, must have been heat-seeking type of missiles, and they shot down one of their own planes also. But the U.S. government stated that it was just a weather plane because they didn't know that the Soviet Union actually recovered the plane. And once the government found out, the U.S. government found out, then the story changed a little bit. But this all just kind of ties in with what was going on back in the 50s and early 60s. It was a time when it was actually a very good time economically. I think our country was thriving, but there was always that threat of the Soviet Union going to do something powerfully dangerous to us. And maybe that was just a scare tactic, but I know growing up as a preteen in that era, it was always on our mind.
Yeah, it wasn't.
You have to fear the Soviet Union.
The whole Sputnik thing happened in that was 1957, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. And I have to mention something about that now that you brought up that Sputnik thing. In 1957, in October, actually, it's almost next month, it'll be an anniversary of it. I remember my dad took my sister and I to a World Series game in Milwaukee where the Braves played the Yankees, and the Braves lost to the Yankees 12-3. Not that that's important, but it sticks in my mind anyway. And that was on October 5th, 1957. And I remember riding home in the car from Milwaukee, and on the radio, they announced that the day before or the night before, the Russians had launched the Sputnik. And it was, you know, in today's terms, it's really not that significant. But back then, it was like, it scared me. It scared everybody, you know, because they thought, uh-oh, they're out there in space. They're going to be able to attack us from all kinds of different angles. And that was the thinking back then. And I remember that well.
Yeah. I wasn't quite born yet, but I did watch that movie about the kid, October Sky, was it? Was that the name of the movie? Where he got, it was a true story about a young boy who saw that Sputnik going overhead after they launched, and he went outside and could see it going over, and then got real interested in building rockets on it. But yeah, so they did depict in that movie how everybody was very concerned about it. And I didn't do any research on this, but I believe the Sputnik itself was a ball, maybe the size of a basketball, with some antenna sticking out of it.
Yeah, it wasn't very big.
Just a little thing. They just somehow managed to get. You know, it wasn't really a threat at all, but it was a example that they had gotten to the point where they could put something into space. So
yes, and we thought that if they could do this, you know, how far are they along on doing something more advanced? And it was kind of the first, you know, entrance into outer space. And it was a big winning point for the Soviet Union at that time.
Right. So did you ever know why they may have called it Area 51? Did you think there were 50 other areas they had named before that? Or...
You know, I never really thought about it before I started doing some research on this. I just took it as Area 51. I thought it was just the government. You know, they use numbers for many things, and I just thought it was a number. And maybe I didn't, in the back of my mind, think that there were 50 other areas that came out, and this one just came along and it was 51. What do you think about that?
Well, I had no idea either. You and I have both had experience working with governmental agencies, and how everything that sounds official is usually an acronym or some simple way of labeling it. Even though it might sound complicated, it's really just a simple thing. And what we found in researching this was supposedly a flying dish purportedly crashed in New Mexico and was later transferred to this base in the year 1951. And this is perhaps an explanation of why it got to be called Area 51.
And that's as good of an explanation for me. I also heard that there's an adjacent area called Area 15 that the Atomic Energy Commission uses a grid numbering system, and just the fact that it was adjacent to Area 15, maybe they'll just name it Area 51. But I like your reason as far as a valid one. It makes sense to me.
Yeah, and I believe the Atomic Energy Commission were the original, I don't know what you call it, landholders or owners of that property, and they were doing... They had exploded some test nuclear bombs in that area.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
This is before, obviously, they started putting a base there.
Mm-hmm.
But then they built several large hangars, and they obviously had a lot going on. And what I guess we'll delve into a little more, but I just wanted to mention this one. You were talking about the U-2 that could fly at 60,000 feet, and this is one I hadn't heard of before. This plane called the Oxcart. Did you hear of this before?
Yes, well, just not before. I did the research just recently, but before that, no.
Yeah, that's interesting. This is a plane that was designed. By the CIA, that travels at three times the speed of sound at 90,000 feet. It has never been shot down and was used over North Vietnam and the Pueblo crisis in North Korea and perhaps made us safer and kept us out of a nuclear war at that time. And I remember this, and I don't know if, you know, for people that were old enough to remember the Pueblo crisis, that was an 11-month ordeal in which North Korea boarded the Navy intelligence ship USS Pueblo and held it hostage, and that was in January of 1968. North Korea claimed it entered their territorial waters, but the U.S. maintains it was in international waters at the time, and that was, like I said, an 11-month ordeal, and I can remember that.
That was one of those topics or events that was, like we mentioned in previous podcasts, something on the nightly news almost every night. They would give a date on it, and you'd turn on the television in the evening, and there it was. They would be talking and showing footage of that hostage situation. And, yeah, like you, I remember that very well.
And it was very dire, because obviously North Korea, I just didn't think it was gonna end well, but it finally did after 11 months.
And then just think, that's North Korea, and just think today how unstable North Korea is today. You know, so nothing has improved and probably has worsened since then.
Certainly, yes. It's worse than any time you have somebody that isn't stable themselves running a country. That's going to be a problem.
Yeah, and that's the problem with a lot of these situations. You know, if you got somebody that, like you mentioned, is unstable, it's scary, because if they control a powerful country or a country that has the ability to be powerful, and you've got somebody that might not quite be in the, you know, playing with all his 10 marbles, you really worry about it, because, you know, you think a reasonable person would not do something drastic, but when you've got somebody unstable, you never know what they're going to do. And, you know, it is all kind of goes back to what I was talking about, this whole area of the late 50s and going into the early 60s now, where the Soviet Union, North Korea, those two were kind of our opponents. And I know that you remember the Cuban Missile Crisis. No, you might not remember the Cuban Missile Crisis, but I'm sure you heard plenty about it as you grew older in 1962, and where Nikita Khrushchev and President Kennedy were kind of at odds, and they kind of had a showdown of wits among them. And it just all ties in together with what was going on with, you know, we mentioned the Sputnik and the U-2 and the Oxcart and all those things. It all kind of ties together. I remember people building bomb shelters in their backyards. We never did in the late 50s. And I remember air raid tests in school, where kids would crawl under their desks like that's going to save them from an air raid or something.
Yeah. Oh. Yes, I remember that. That was actually broke up the monotony of the school.
Here we go, under the desk.
Nuclear bomb test, yeah.
Yeah, that's really going to save us. But well, maybe it made us feel a little better.
They made desks pretty sturdy back then, Chuck. I don't know. It may have helped.
Yes, not like they do today, that's for sure.
No. So, also, I think we stated this, but there are the warning signs along the whole border of Area 51 stating that photography is prohibited and the use of deadly force is authorized. But there's been lots of pictures taken, a lot, including by the Soviet Union, with satellite imagery, and so there are pictures you can go on Google or wherever right now and see pictures of the base. And apparently, there's still a lot going on there, even though they kind of make it sound like there isn't, or like they may have abandoned it, but that's not necessarily the case.
I don't think so. I don't think it's being abandoned at all. And like you mentioned, the overhead satellite images can give you some very crystal clear images of something from overhead, at least. Perhaps you can't get the on-the-ground views that somebody would want, but the overhead images are, you know, it's hard to hide anything from overhead these days.
Right, and they have such a huge area, like we said before. Now it's expanded to 23 by 25 miles, and the main base is in the middle there. That's 6 by 10 miles, but that's a large area. So if you're just trying, if you're on the other side of the fence of that, trying to see what you can, that's, you know, 10, 15 miles in, you're just not going to see a whole lot.
That's what I was thinking. You know, it might be interesting to do that, but I'm thinking, what are you really going to see?
Well, if they are testing flights of whatever planes or vehicles or whatever, then you may see something like that. But yeah, you're not going to actually be able to see the buildings very well anymore, or, you know, things going in and out of the buildings, that kind of, you know, that kind of thing.
Right. Well, in 1974, I know the astronauts, you're kind of tying in with this satellite imagery. The astronauts aboard Skylab 4, they were instructed not to photograph Area 51, and that was the only place that they were instructed not to photograph, which would seem to indicate that no other spot on Earth was considered, at least by the U.S. government, to be as sensitive as Area 51.
Yeah, that is interesting that they would specifically tell them not to photograph that area.
All right.
And so then in the 1990s, Area 51 became a tourist attraction, and people from all over the world would go as close as they were allowed to the southern shore of Groom Lake, hoping to catch a glimpse of the area.
Can you picture yourself doing that?
I believe there were people that were actually giving tours. You know, they'd take a little minivan or whatever and load a couple people up and drive them out and show them the different, I don't know, different spots along the fence to try to look into. I don't know what exactly that would, what else you'd have a tour of.
I know. I guess if you're out in that area, it might be, if you had nothing else to do that day, maybe I would do it for the fun of it.
But I guess drive up to one of the signs and said, that says if you go past this site, a deadly force will be used.
Yeah, you could take a picture of yourself standing next to that sign, perhaps.
Yeah, I guess that would be kind of neat.
And I know the government burned hazardous waste in open trenches and claimed it could do so despite environmental laws that should have prevented it, because they claimed Area 51 was a legal non-entity. In other words, it did not exist, even though it really did exist. A court ruling eventually found that environmental laws truly did apply to Area 51, but President Clinton signed a document exempting the base staff from having to testify about activities on the base.
Can you believe that a government entity would claim that they can go ahead and do anything that would harm people just because they can say, well, we really don't exist, so it's okay if we burn this real hazardous waste in this real area, even though we're saying it doesn't exist?
You know, I can't believe. And, John, we're talking about these topics, and we talk about governments, and not just the United States governments, but governments in general. Going back to when we first mentioned the U-2 plane being shot down and the U.S. government didn't admit what really happened. And, you know, I don't believe anything that a government official says about what supposedly happens, because they're going to try to present it in the best light that they possibly can. And how accurate or truthful it all is, you know, I just don't put a lot of faith in anybody that says this stuff.
Yeah, I just think it's just mind-boggling to come up with that explanation. We can go ahead and do this because it really doesn't exist.
Yeah, so I read that some of the hazardous material that might have been burned in these trenches was the leftover paint from the stealth bombers. Apparently they had some special paint that helped to make it less visible to radar, and that paint was very toxic, and apparently that was one of the things that might have been burned in these trenches that they claim.
Yeah. Also, I believe the Blackbird was developed there, or at least tested some test flights there.
Yes, yes.
And that, I actually saw that in person one time at an air show. That's another incredible airplane that if I remember correctly, they said that when it's on the ground, they load up the gasoline in the tanks, and then they have to take off because as they're loading it up, the way it's designed, the gasoline is actually leaking out on the ground. And when they take off, the pressure of flying in the air or whatever, it expands the metal and then it seals it. But while it's on the ground, it leaks fuel out.
That's interesting. I never heard that.
Yeah, and it's just one of those things where they just couldn't figure out a way to not make it leak on the ground because they had to account for this expansion when they were in the air. So,
oh, interesting. And so they can't have it loaded with fuel waiting to go. They have to fill it up with fuel and then take off.
So. Yeah, they wouldn't. Well, yeah, they just have to keep filling it up, I guess, until they were ready to take off. So. Mm-hmm. So, but there are some obviously interesting stories about this Area 51, and there's a lot of conspiracy theories around it, and some of those include the reverse engineering of alien spacecraft, perhaps including whatever they may have found at Roswell, New Mexico, and perhaps we can talk about that on a show one time, but that may tie in with right around the beginning of when this space started. Another one is weather control experiments, possibly time travel, activities related to, here we go again with this one, the One World Government.
That's a topic that we talked about in quite a bit of detail in regards to the Denver airport, one of the earlier podcasts.
Yes. And also exotic weapons development. Well, I guess I'm pretty sure that's not a conspiracy theory. I'm sure that's happening. And also meetings with extraterrestrials. So if they are, if the reverse engineering is going on, I would think that last one might be a possibility too.
And you know, that reverse engineering, perhaps not necessarily associated with alien spacecraft, although it could be. It actually goes on a lot in with different countries. For example, there's a B-29 that crashed in, I think it was in Russia, and Russia recovered it, and it was pretty much intact. And it involves disassembling the aircraft totally and analyzing its components and the workings in pretty much detail. And as a result of them, the Russians, or the Soviet Union back then, I guess it was, they developed almost a near-perfect copy of the B-29. It was called the Tupolev Tu-4, so it was almost identical to the B-29 from the United States Air Force.
Yeah, there's. I'm sure there's a lot of that going on. I think I heard about when we had somehow captured either a downed or just captured a, was it a Russian MiG, I believe, at one point. So they took it, and I don't know if they took it to Area 51 or not, but I know they took it somewhere and basically learned how to fly it and learn all the all what it could do and what it could not do. And it was a big benefit because now they knew exactly what it was capable of and what it was not capable of. So they knew how to attack it or get away from it.
Right. And there were some movies over the years that have been made that have referenced Area 51, including Independence Day, which I'm sure many of our listeners will remember, in 1996. And that includes reference to Roswell and also to Area 51. And there's another one, John, I think is pretty interesting about a baseball team. Can you tell me about that one?
There's a AAA team. They're called the Las Vegas 51s, and they were formerly the Las Vegas Stars. And I remember that. I think they used to be a San Diego Padres affiliate when they were the Stars.
Yes, they were.
And I didn't know that they had changed their name, and now they're a New York Mets affiliate, but they had changed their name to the Las Vegas 51s. And the team logo depicts one of the gray aliens that are thought to possibly maybe be there at Area 51. So
it just shows you how this Area 51 is actually built into our whole culture. It isn't just this mysterious base. It's something that almost everyone knows about. If you don't know much about it, you've probably at least heard about it. And I'm sure if you're out in that area in Las Vegas or out west, any place close to there, you are very familiar with Area 51 and all the lore that surrounds it.
Yes. I just wanted to go back and mention, you know, the Groom Lake, which I was talking about earlier, and I found the information on the dried remnant of a lake that last held water during the Pleistocene age. Sediments deposited in the lake consisted largely of reworked silt and clay that were first deposited in an older and larger lake that occupied the same basin during the Tiocene age, ending about a million years ago. When the lake dried up, starting about 10,000 years ago, it left a clay deposit. The light-colored, fine-grained sediments filled the basin to an unknown depth and have been compacted to the point where the surface hardness easily supports the weight of an airplane during takeoff and landing operations. Heavy rains caused the lake bed to soften and retain water for months at a time. When this happens, copepods, a kind of brine shrimp, emerge from the mud and enjoy their life cycle until the lake bed dries out again.
And this happens every year, perhaps?
Well, I don't know if it happens every year. It is sort of a desolate area. It may. I don't know if it happens every year, but it would probably. I don't know. Does that area even have a rainy season? I don't know.
Well, I know Arizona does in the summer months, you know, starting from June through probably early September, it can be very rainy. The day starts out very clear in the morning, and then by midday, you know, there's usually storms or heavy rain, at least for a short time, almost every day for a while.
And then just one other interesting thing about the Area 51, and you're wondering, it is sort of a large base of operations with a lot going on, and there are government employees that work there, and quite a few of them. And there are actually flights from McCarran International Airport in Las Vegas, Nevada, that fly to and from Area 51 every day. And there's an airline devoted to that. It's called Janet Airlines. It's a small fleet of passenger aircraft operated for the United States Air Force. Their aircraft transport military and contractor employees and currently serve mostly the Nevada National Security Site, most notably Area 51, from their terminal at Las Vegas McCarran International Airport. The origin of the term Janet is obscure, but it is used as a radio call sign.
Well, that must be a very secure system in order to have these people go into this Area 51. You would think that the security surrounding people getting off and on that plane in Las Vegas has to be pretty high.
Yes, I'm sure it is. And just like everything else, the people that are brought in, like we talked about other government things going on at the Denver airport, and that where it's so compartmentalized, I'm sure when people are brought in, they're working on a specific thing, they go to that building or hangar and they come back out and they're not allowed to go anywhere else. And the same with the people that are operating the airlines. I don't know if they're even allowed off the plane or not, because it's not that far of a flight.
No, it probably takes half hour at the most.
Yeah. But I guess if you're flying in and out of Las Vegas, you may notice these airplanes are just a white airplane, and they have a red stripe on the side that runs right along the window line on both sides. So if you happen to be flying into Las Vegas and you see one of those, you'll know where that plane is headed.
I'll have to watch for that. I don't have any plans to go out there in the near future, but if I ever do, I will. See, it's a good thing we're talking about this, because it's just going to enrich our lives, all this knowledge we're picking up here.
Yeah.
You know, and I mentioned this earlier in this podcast, but the United States and most countries, we need a secret place to develop weapons and test other strategies. I mean, this to find a place like this is not surprising at all. I think almost every country of any size, of any major power, has an area like Area 51, and probably more than one area like Area 51. Because secrecy, it's really important when you're dealing with potential wars. For example, I know most of you have heard about the Manhattan Project, where they created the atomic bomb.
Yes.
In World War II. Actually, Vice President Harry Truman did not know about the bomb until he became president on April 12th of 1944. So that was, one, two, three, about 4 months prior to
when he gave the orders to drop the bomb.
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, he just turned, and actually no members of Congress, not even a couple of special military types didn't know about the bomb until after it was dropped. So you know that a project like this, the Manhattan Project or whatever is going on in Area 51, involves a great deal of secrecy. And it's not surprising that we have an area like this.
Yes, yeah. And, it's a good thing that you and I are not, for instance, Chinese, because if we were doing a podcast on their secret military base area,
you probably wouldn't be here tomorrow.
No. We'd be in trouble. So,
well, at least we'd be shut off. That kind of reminds me of going back to the Art Bell that we just talked about. Not only was there that caller that was flying in to the Area 51 that called in, but there was another caller, maybe more than one, a caller that knew a lot about what was going on in Area 51, and he was talking to Art Bell, and all of a sudden the transmission from Art Bell's station cut off, and it was off the air for at least a minute or maybe a little bit longer.
Yeah.
And Art Bell said, "Whoa, what was that?" That this happened when we were talking about this supposedly secret area.
Yeah. And, I remember that, hearing that, and, listening to some podcasts of old shows of his, and that same program with other people on. Seemed like that happened fairly often. I'm just wondering if that was really happening that often, or if that was kind of a planned thing to add dramatic effect.
You always have that suspicion. I mean, it made for good theater on the radio, and you like to think what you're hearing is accurate and true, but you just don't know. And you know, you got to have a little bit of suspicion about it because it is pretty fantastic when you read about it.
It is. Either way, it was very entertaining. So,
and when you're listening to it at midnight, it adds a little bit more of the drama to the whole event too.
Yeah, and just to end the show here, I just wanted to say that just recently there appears to be a huge project underway at that Area 51. Apparently, there's a new hangar that is in the process of being built or has already been built that is three times the size of the largest building that's there. And we don't really have the exact size of how big this is, but there are significant things still happening at this base. Like I said, this huge new building being built, and there's a lot of activity still going on there. I know maybe some people were under the impression that once it got to be real popular that they just kind of stopped using it, but that doesn't appear to be the case.
No, I'm sure it is a good area for these secret operations, and I'm sure they could find another area that would be suitable to, but I think they've got, even though there's a lot of interest in Area 51, I think the security surrounding it is very thorough, so I think the government feels comfortable in, you know, expanding their operations there, and I'm not surprised that they are.
Yeah. So, is there anything else we should mention, Chuck?
Well, you know, John, I think we've actually covered it quite a bit. I mean, in the purpose of this podcast, I think we've gone into a sufficient amount of detail to give our listeners a pretty good summary of what's going on there. And so, I think this is pretty good. This is enough for now.
Okay. Well, again, thanks to everyone for listening to our podcast. We certainly appreciate it. And if you'd like to leave feedback, you can contact us at mysterioustopics.com and just click on the contact and send us an email. And you can also leave some feedback on iTunes or Stitcher or whatever device you may be listening on, Windows, phones, and there's a couple other areas that we're also available at. I'll have that information in the next podcast coming up. But anyway, I just wanted to thank everybody, and
I hope people will email us with comments and probably some critical comments. I'm sure there are many areas of these podcasts that we can improve upon, and any kind of a negative or positive comments would be welcome. And we really thank you so much for listening, and I hope you have enjoyed this podcast and our previous podcasts. So that is it for this podcast, and goodbye.
Goodbye.